Hi, I'm VOA's Alexis Strope with your worldwide news update. The U.S. says about 8,000 North Korean troops now at Ukraine's border are expected in combat soon. AP correspondent Ed Donahue reports.
Secretary of State Antony Blinken says Russians have been training North Korean troops with the intention of fully using them in frontline operations. Blinken also said Vladimir Putin's troops are suffering.
It's desperate. Putin has been throwing more and more Russians into a meat grinder of his own making in Ukraine. Now, he's turning to North Korean troops, and that is a clear sign of weakness.
Kremlin forces have struggled to push back a Ukrainian incursion into Kursk. The Russian representative at the UN Security Council did not respond. I'm Ed Donahue.
Israel's Channel 12 said on Thursday a Hezbollah attack on northern Israel killed five people, while Beirut said Israeli strikes had killed six health workers in southern Lebanon. Zachary Goldman from Reuters reports.
An Israeli helicopter carrying wounded landed at a hospital in Haifa after Israeli TV reported a Hezbollah rocket attack on the northern town of Matula had killed five people on Thursday. The dead included an Israeli farmer and four foreign workers. Lebanese TV showed plumes of smoke following Israeli strikes in the cities of Tyre and Baalbek. Beirut said the strikes had killed six health workers in southern Lebanon. The continued fighting and rising death toll in the conflict between Israeli forces and Hezbollah fighters comes as U.S. envoys Brett McGurk and Amos Hochstein arrived in Israel to press for a truce in Lebanon and in Gaza. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu told the envoys that Israel's ability to counter threats to its security from Lebanon and return displaced people to the north had to be key elements of any ceasefire. Lebanon's caretaker Prime Minister Najib Mikati said in an interview Wednesday he'd spoken to Hochstein and that he hoped for a ceasefire in coming hours or days.
That was Reuters correspondent Zachary Goldman. This is VOA News. The death toll from devastating flash floods in eastern Spain rose to at least 158 on Thursday. Reuters correspondent Arthi Thiaparin reports.
A Spanish government minister said dozens and dozens of people were still unaccounted for after a year's worth of rain fell in 8 hours in parts of the Valencia region on Tuesday. Prime Minister Pedro Sanchez urged people in flooded areas to stay at home due to the threat of more stormy weather. He said the government will keep providing resources to search for missing people as long as necessary. Opposition politicians accused the central government of acting too slowly to warn residents and send in rescue teams. That prompted the Interior Ministry to say regional authorities were responsible for civil protection measures. Spain's transport minister said about 50 miles of roads in the eastern region were seriously damaged or impassable, some blocked by cars containing dead bodies.
That was Reuters correspondent Arthi Thiaparin. Hundreds of Ecuadorians marched on the streets of Quito on Thursday for an anti-government protest, blaming President Daniel Noboa for an energy crisis that has seen power outages of up to 14 hours daily. Ecuador's worst drought in over 60 years has plunged the hydropower-dependent country into an energy crisis as diminished reservoirs leave hydroelectric dams offline, pushing the government to impose power cuts to limit the strain on electricity supplies. The European Union Thursday announced a formal investigation into Chinese-founded e-commerce platform Temu on suspicion the site is doing too little to stop the sale of illegal products in a probe that could lead to large fines. VOA's Jeff Custer reports.
Temu is extremely popular in the EU despite having entered the continent's market only last year. The platform has on average around 92 million monthly active users in the bloc. At a news conference in Brussels, EU spokesman Thomas Reynier said the probe was being launched because they believe Temu could be in violation of the Digital Services Act, a massive law designed to protect European online consumers. Reynier said Temu could face stiff consequences if it is found to be in violation of the law.
If these suspicions are proven correct, the Commission could decide to impose a fine going up to 6% of Temu's global annual turnover. The Commission will now carry out an in-depth investigation, and we invite Temu to cooperate during the process.
Jeff Custer, VOA News.
Canadian police dismantled what they say is the largest, most sophisticated illicit drug super lab in the country. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police believe organized crime ran the operation where there was mass production and distribution of fentanyl and methamphetamine across Canada and internationally. Officers served search warrants last week on the drug lab in Falkland, British Columbia, and associated locations in Surrey in Metro Vancouver. That wraps up this update, but the world and news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website. I'm Alexis Strope, VOA News.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Friday, November 1st, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Can a Nebraska Nice politician win over rural America and become the next U.S. vice president?
I grew up in Butte, Nebraska, a town of 400 people. I had 24 kids in my high school class.
We also have the profile of Republican vice presidential candidate J.D. Vance. A Liberian immigrant runs for a third two-year term. Malawi begins nationwide fuel rationing as its crisis deepens. Kenya's high court clears the way for the swearing-in of a new deputy president today, Friday.
In Nairobi on Friday, Professor Abraham Kithure Kindiki will be sworn in as the new deputy president of the Republic of Kenya.
Those stories, plus Samson O'Malley Sports, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. It's four more days before Americans go to the polls to elect either Vice President Kamala Harris or former President Donald Trump as their next president. This morning, we bring you profiles of their vice presidential candidates. Tim Walz was elected two terms as governor of the Midwestern state of Minnesota before he became Kamala Harris's pick for vice president. On the campaign trail, he speaks about his formative days in Nebraska and how they shaped the person, candidate, and governor that he has become. Viewer's Natasha Moskova visited the state to learn more about how the people of Nebraska remember Walz and feel about him now.
Democratic vice presidential candidate Tim Walz spent the first half of his life in this rural part of Nebraska, about a five-hour drive from the nearest major airport. Here, the most prominent landscape features are often the grain silos. Some people here see a part of themselves in the vice presidential candidate.
When I see him on TV, he does not remind me of a politician. He reminds me of what would be my favorite teacher in school, because he's really invested in his community and his students. And he really has a high moral compass and good moral values.
Walz was born in West Point, Nebraska, and spent his childhood in Valentine, population 2600. Not exactly known for its political heavy hitters.
We followed Tim's career, I guess, a little bit at a distance. This step, we probably didn't see this one coming.
When Walz was a teenager, his father's lung cancer diagnosis prompted the family to move 160 kilometers to the north, closer to the extended family.
I grew up in Butte, Nebraska, a town of 400 people. I had 24 kids in my high school class.
Walz's family members still live in the area. His uncle, retired farmer Jerome Raymond, says he plans to vote for his nephew, but adds that he is a bit worried the small-town kid he remembers is too kind to confront the big world's challenges.
He was just your average kid. I mean, he was a good guy. Loved sports. Tim isn't going to be tough enough for Putin. It concerns me.
Growing up in the rural Midwest, Walz became an avid fisherman and hunter, not shy about his love of guns. Walz's camouflage hat was embraced by the Dirt Road Democrats.
Camouflage hunting represents Nebraska, I guess, and we're just taking it back for this ticket.
Following in the footsteps of his father, a Korean War veteran, Walz joined the National Guard at age 17, serving for 24 years. But for some rural voters, Walz's military service and history of gun ownership does not mean he shares the same values.
Nah, he ain't close. He lying through his teeth. That's Second Amendment right. I ain't taking his guns away like they're trying to do us.
Walz also supports abortion rights, which puts him at odds with many in conservative Nebraska, where some churches have memorials for the unborn, and the landscape is dotted with anti-abortion signs.
The most important issue for me has always been pro-life. Whoever is pro-life is who I vote for. He won't get my vote.
Walz received his education degree from Chedron State College, in a town where former President Donald Trump seems to be popular. The college administration recently had to take down his campaign flag after someone hoisted it next to the U.S. flag on campus. Chedron resident Miles Bannon says Tim Walz's local roots do not necessarily translate to support.
There's a lot of families who don't talk about politics very much because there's a lot of disagreements, you know, and I think that there's a lot of people who are comforted by him, but that may not change the way they vote.
Some here say that Walz has given rural Nebraska its 15 minutes of fame. But in this conservative U.S. state, shared roots isn't a guarantee of votes. Natasha Mozgova, VOA News in rural Nebraska.
The life of U.S. Republican vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance is a typical story of small-town boy makes good. He grew up in the poor mountainous area of Appalachia, attended an Ivy League school, and could end up elected as one of the youngest vice presidents in history. But first, VOA's senior Washington correspondent Carolyn Presutti takes us back to his roots.
This isn't where he was born, but this is where J.D. Vance calls home, Jackson, Kentucky.
Now, when I proposed to my wife, I said, honey, I come with $120,000 worth of law school debt and a cemetery plot on a mountainside in eastern Kentucky.
Breathitt County, Kentucky Sheriff John Holland drives us on a dusty dirt road and parks on a slight hill. He opens a rusty gate to show us that plot.
Grandmother Bonnie Blanton Vance.
Vance's grandmother was known as Mama.
He always came down here with Mama, and she would bring him to the mountains to let him see what mountain life was, and he evidently liked it.
He was born in Middletown, Ohio, and raised mainly by his strict Mama, who cursed a lot and kept 19 loaded handguns in this house. With his stepfather's last name, J.D. Hamill won his first election, ironically as vice president of his Middletown high school class. He served as a Marine and then graduated summa cum laude from The Ohio State University. Then on to Yale, where Vance clicked with fellow law student Usha Chilakode, his future wife. College buddy James Imers knew them both.
I think she was able to channel some of that to J.D., really kind of help him decide what he wanted to do and help, you know, kind of shape his future path in general from law school.
Vance became known nationally through his 2016 bestseller-turned-movie, Hillbilly Elegy, about working-class America. It stars Glenn Close as a blunt mama to a young J.D.
But you got to decide you want to be somebody or not.
With the support of former President Donald Trump, J.D. Vance, the boy from Ohio who loves Kentucky, was elected as a senator from Ohio. And a quick 2 years later,
J.D. Vance to be the next vice president of the United States.
Trump chose Vance as his running mate, but he got off to a rough start, having previously called Trump, quote, reprehensible, and having claimed to be, quote, a never Trump guy. Now, as the nominee, Vance's policies reflect Trump's. And when asked, did the former president lose the 2020 election?
No. I think there are serious problems in 2020. So did Donald Trump lose the election? Not by the words that I would use.
Vance is hawkish on China and East Asia, opposes military aid to Ukraine, and
ma'am,
could you tell me how you handled it?
In answer to my question on the Israel-Hamas conflict,
Kamala Harris on the one hand says that she really cares about civilian casualties, and yet she refuses to give Israel the weapons that allow them to minimize civilian casualties.
Vance's hometown of Middletown is largely Trump country. Steve Dillman hired Vance for his first job at age 16.
I'm very proud of what he's accomplished, and to be a part of that, it makes me really feel good inside. This is a man that has come from McKinley Street, and now he could potentially be the vice president of the United States.
If elected, Vance at age 40 would become the third youngest vice president in history.
Let's get to work and make it happen.
Carolyn Presutti, VOA News.
When Americans vote on November 5th, they will also choose members of the Senate and the House of Representatives, as well as local offices. Some of the local candidates are of African descent. One of them is Nequita Ricks, of Liberian descent, who is seeking re-election for her third two-year term as Colorado State Representative for District 40. She tells me that her challenger is a MAGA, or Make America Great Again, Republican.
We are really making a big effort this weekend to get out the vote. The turnout has been a little bit slow so far, and I know a lot of people wait until the last minute to turn in their ballots, but it's better if we can get more ballots in. So there's so many different efforts and push to get, you know, from souls to the polls through the churches to community organizations. We're going to be knocking doors, sending out text messages and voicemail messages to ensure that we're able to get people to return their ballots.
The last time we spoke, at, I think it was 2022, you were seeking, I think, re-election for your Colorado district number 40, and you won. How is it this time? How is it this time?
I plan to win again. And so I'm running for re-election for my third term. I have served 4 years already in the Colorado General Assembly, and I'm going for my third term. So I will be running again in 2026.
So do you have someone running against you?
Yes. I am running against a MAGA Republican candidate, and so I do have an opponent.
What are you running on now, seeking re-election?
So I'm seeking re-election based on the work that I have already done. But in the Colorado State House, I have been a champion for fighting for people to keep their homes, fighting for affordable housing, fighting for small businesses so that they also have access to state contracts. I've been a strong fighter for consumer protection, ensuring that people, Coloradoans, are receiving transparency and equity in the transactions that they make here in Colorado. And so I'm going back. There's still a lot of work to be done. We're hearing that the state budget this year is going to be tight. So most of the stuff that we're going to be doing will be things that don't impact the budget, but there's still a lot of work to be done.
Nikita Ricks is a Liberian-born immigrant candidate who is seeking re-election for her third two-year term as Colorado State Representative for District 40. She was speaking with us from Aurora, Colorado. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barton in Washington. Today is Friday, November 1st. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms. We are on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Still to come on our program, Samson O'Malley's Horse. Kenya's High Court on Thursday lifted orders blocking newly appointed Deputy President Kithure Kindiki from being sworn into office. The ruling deals a blow to impeach the Deputy President Rigathi Gachagua, whose lawyers filed some 30 legal challenges to his ouster following charges of gross misconduct and undermining the president. VOA's Nairobi Bureau Chief Maria Madialo reports.
Kenya's three-judge bench gave numerous reasons for Thursday's decision, with Justice Anthony Murima reading an excerpt of the ruling to explain why they're letting the East African country's newly appointed deputy president assume office.
Public interest in this matter favors giving way to the Constitution, which in any event is the will of the people. That is also the dictate under Article 3 of the Constitution, where every person has an obligation to respect, uphold, and defend the Constitution. We choose to abide by that calling. As such, public interest demands that the office of the Deputy President should not remain vacant.
Earlier this month, Kenya's Senate voted to uphold 5 of the 11 charges against impeached former Deputy President Rigathi Gachagua, including constitutional violation and charges of corruption that he has dismissed as politically motivated. President William Ruto promptly chose Interior Minister Kithure Kindiki to replace Gachagua, whose lawyers challenged the appointment. The High Court had suspended further action until it could hear both sides. Since then, the court has faced questions and petitions from Gachagua's lawyers, including challenges to the validity of the panel's appointment and to their impartiality, both of which were rejected. The whole process has divided Kenyans, with some, like James Chege, telling VOA they agreed with Gachagua's impeachment, while others, like Edwin Mugalo, found it distasteful, especially because the deputy president fell ill while the proceedings were happening.
The outgoing deputy president was too abrasive. He could not tone down his language.
It wasn't good, and especially you are impeaching somebody when he's in hospital. I think it was so untimely.
Gachagua was Ruto's running mate in the 2022 election, but had recently spoken of being politically marginalized, highlighting the friction and tension between him and his former boss. Historian Kenneth Ambongi of the University of Nairobi says he's surprised the Ruto-Gachagua partnership lasted as long as it did.
If I look at historical patterns, what is happening is always expected. The two are of the same characteristics. I know our president is strong, determined, self-opinionated. Same thing with Gachagua. We say two bulls cannot share one kraal.
Mariama Diallo, VOA News, Nairobi.
In Kenya, newly appointed Deputy President Kithure Kindiki will be sworn in today, Friday. He will replace impeached Deputy President Rigathi Gachagua. Political reporter Barack Odwa of the People's Daily tells me that Kindiki and President William Ruto have known each other for some time.
In Nairobi on Friday, Professor Abraham Kithure Kindiki will be sworn in as the new Deputy President of the Republic of Kenya. Remember, on Thursday, the court in Nairobi lifted the order barring the swearing-in or taking oath of Professor Kindiki. The embattled former Deputy President Rigathi Gachagua had gone to court to stop the swearing-in of Mr. Kindiki, but the court on Thursday lifted the order, paving way for that particular swearing-in.
What can you tell us about Professor Kindiki? Who is he, and why do you think President Ruto chose him?
Professor Abraham Kithure Kindiki is a very close ally or friend of President William Ruto. First, you will be able to recall that Professor Kindiki was President William Ruto's lawyer at the International Criminal Court when the president was facing criminal charges at ICC, or the International Criminal Court, following the 2007 post-election violence in Kenya. Professor Kithure Kindiki is also a respected human rights lawyer and a senior legal mind in Kenya and beyond. Professor Kindiki is a former senator of a county called Taraka Nithi in the central part of Kenya. Kindiki is also the immediate former interior minister, or minister of internal security, if you like. He is the minister who was at the helm when the country was facing protest against President William Ruto's administration, where over 60 Kenyans died following police brutality.
Barack Odwa is the political reporter for the People Daily of Kenya. He was speaking with us from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. Malawi has directed fuel retailers to ration sales to consumers to ensure fair distribution amid a severe fuel crisis now entering its third week. The Malawi Energy Regulatory Authority says the move is meant to ensure fair access to fuel across the country. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
Henry Gachagua is the chief executive officer for the Malawi Energy Regulatory Authority. He told a press conference Thursday that the crisis has worsened because of people buying fuel in bulk to sell on the black market.
Where we see that retailers are prioritizing vendors, we are going to take stiff measures against such retailers, which we include, but not limited to, either a suspension or even an outright revocation of their trading license.
Malawi has been facing recurring fuel shortage since August 2022, largely because the country lacks enough foreign currency. However, the current situation started early October. Now, long queues have become a daily experience nationwide, with some people even sleeping in the queue for fuel. Drivers of passenger service vehicles have increasingly relied on black market fuel, where prices have tripled. These additional costs are being passed on to commuters, who now pay fares that have doubled in price. However, Gachagua could not specify when the fuel shortage might ease.
I cannot be definite in terms of a particular date when we expect this challenge to go, but I would like to assure Malawians that all efforts are being put to ensure that we recover as quickly as possible.
Malawi government spokesperson Moses Kunkuyo told a press conference last week that foreign exchange shortages persist.
Since June 2024, when fuel demand was very high, the forex available to fuel importers has been much less than needed. Each month, about $37 million was provided, but we actually need $51 million per month to meet the demand.
However, Kachaja of the Malawi Energy Regulatory Authority said the government has now acquired some funds for purchasing fuel now on its way from ports of Beira and Nacala in Mozambique. For VOA Africa, I am Lamek Masina in Blantyre.
It is time now for Daybreak Africa Sports, and here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you too, James. We begin the sport with the Confederation of African Football. The continent's governing body has released the final schedule for the CAF Women's Champions League Morocco 2024. DR Congo's TP Mazembe, South Africa's Double Tones, the University of the Western Cape, host ASFA of Morocco, Senegal's Agels Dola Medina, title holders Mamelodi Sundowns, Egypt's FC Masar, CBE of Ethiopia, and Nigeria's Edo Queens are the eight teams participating. The fourth edition of the Africa's Premier Women's Club Tournament will take place from the 9th to the 23rd of November in the cities of Al Jadida and Casablanca in Morocco. All 16 matches will be played between the two venues, with the final scheduled to take place in Al Jadida on Saturday, the 23rd of November. The International School Sports Federation Gymnasiad Games were concluded on Thursday in Bahrain. Uganda won three medals at the 11th edition of the ISF Gymnasiad Games. Two of the medals, silver, was from athletics and one bronze in tennis. Overall, Uganda was 34th out of the 71 nation, 42 medal-winning countries, and 5th out of the 19 African countries which took part. In Africa, Morocco had 41 medals, with Algeria following on 48 medals on the overall medals table. In basketball, semi-finalists have emerged in the ongoing Women's Basketball League Africa Zone 5 qualifiers after the quarterfinal actions were concluded on Thursday. Rwanda Energy Group saw off JKL Lady Dolphins of Uganda 67-52 points to continue their unbeaten run and sail through into the semis. Another Rwandan side, APR, also advanced to the knockout stage following a 67-55 win over Gladiators. Egypt's Al Ahly proved too strong for Tanzania's Vijana Queens with a 130-47 victory to book a spot in the semis. Defending champions Kenya Ports Authority secured an 80-63 victory over rivals Equity Bank Hawks in an all-Kenyan affair to play the semifinal, which will take place on Friday, November the 1st. Staying with basketball news, FIBA has announced that the second edition of the FIBA Africa Women's Basketball League will take place in Dakar, Senegal. The competition, scheduled for December 6th to the 15th, will bring together top African women's clubs to vie for continental glory. Dakar will be the second African city since Cairo in 2023 to host the newly revamped FIBA Africa Women's Basketball League. 12 teams from different corners of the continent are expected to participate in the event. And that does it for this Friday's edition of Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a nice weekend. And that's it for this Friday, November 1st edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending your week with us. For more Africa news and features, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Connect with us on all social media platforms, including Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. We are also on YouTube, where you can watch our TV shows, Africa 54, Straight Talk Africa, and Red Carpet. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing that you will have a great weekend. We'll see you again on Monday morning.
Beauty pageants have evolved over time. Today, they emphasize a combination of intelligence, talent, community service, and advocacy. This week on Our Voices, we'll explore how contestants use pageant as platforms to highlight social issues and discuss the challenges the beauty pageant contestant of color face. Join the conversation on Wednesdays at 1900 UTC.